Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back with another episode of our top 100 movies of all time. We're into the 60s finally, and we are going in at number 69, talking about Annie Hall and The Empire Strikes Back. And this is an interesting dynamic here because The Empire Strikes Back is obviously the sequel to A New Hope, the original Star Wars. And Annie Hall is the movie that won Best Picture over the original Star Wars. So I think it's kind of interesting to look at these two side by side. Neither one of us have A New Hope in our top 100. So we're looking at just Annie Hall and just The Empire Strikes Back. But John, you have the more popular movie of the night. How's everything going?
Everything's going quite well. Was able to get quite a few movies in this week and still managed to watch both of these two fantastic movies in the meantime.
Yeah, I watched, so I had off on Sunday and Monday for Labor Day down here, and on Sunday, my fiance was at her bachelorette, so I watched 6 movies that day. That was a wonderful day because I have really fallen behind. I was on like a movie a day pace and things like that, and I have just really, really, really fallen behind on that. It's become a pipe dream to try to get to that level again, but you know what? It's one of those, like, that was a nice day to just be able to sit down and do it, and I'm coming off watching, I'm halfway through season 3 of Dark. So
there you go.
I have that going too. So it's always good to watch that when you can't just watch movies all the time anyway. But all right, John, well, I guess, and I'll let you take over real quick, but I guess Annie Hall is probably the least popular of these two movies.
I mean, it's hard to say because they're both quite popular movies in their own rights. But yeah, I would say Annie Hall is a little less popular nowadays with the ever proliferation of the Star Wars franchise.
Yeah, so the Star Wars franchise is the gift that keeps on giving but like won't stop giving, and I feel like is starting to teeter close to that level of it's giving too much. But we will talk about that when we get to Empire, because it's funny how back when Empire comes out is just the second Star Wars movie ever, they weren't trying to do anything outrageous. And I think that's what makes it work. But on the other hand, you have Annie Hall, which comes out in 1977 and was trying to do everything outrageous. And so to me, this is Woody Allen's masterpiece, and it's really not even close in my eyes. Woody Allen was pretty much turning out a movie a year for a period of time. He just was boom, 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 boom. Midnight in Paris was really his last like hit. After that, it was just kind of all the same schlock. But back in the late 70s, early 80s, he was just doing this neurotic Jewish man thing in New York City. I mean, Manhattan is literally Annie Hall 2. It's the same movie. It's crazy. But what I love about this movie is when you say to somebody, hey, like Annie Hall won Best Picture and it's a romantic comedy, you go into that with expectations of what romantic comedies really are nowadays, or what they were in the 90s, or what they were in the 80s, or what they were in the 70s, what romantic comedies have literally been forever. And that is guy meets girl, they fall in love, and it kind of just then takes place. And yeah, we have these high concept ones like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which comes out and blows people away, and that, you know, obviously garners all these awards, and I think it's my number 4 or something like that. But Annie Hall was so ahead of its time, and its look at just a real relationship. And Woody Allen in this movie uses every single trick at his disposal to the point where it could start to feel gimmicky, but he's in on the gimmick with you. And I think that's what works so well, is he is winking at you the whole time when he's doing the animation, when he's looking at the camera and talking to you, when he is, you know, when he's using the same Groucho Marx joke twice in the movie. Mm-hmm. Yes, he is doing all of this very, very purposefully, and he knows that it's going to rub some people the wrong way. But for the era that this came out and for what it did, I would honestly say that other than Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, this might be the most original romantic comedy if you look at when it actually came out and what it then did for the romantic comedy genre and how nobody's been able to replicate it. Nobody can replicate Annie Hall. They try, but they just cannot hit that same level of what Annie Hall was.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that Woody Allen really presents his own witticism when he in his films, and so much of there's so much talking in this movie. Mm-hmm. There are almost no moments of silence in this entire movie, and that's just Allen's mastery of language and his understanding of how he can use all of that language to just push through the movie and not make it you seem over inundated with all.
I lost John. All right, I lost John. So he said over inundated, but I agree with him. The thing with Woody Allen is Woody Allen, he's pretty much doing his stand-up bits as he goes through this movie. This whole movie is a stand-up routine for Woody Allen so that he can get in there and he can have his jokes and he can say what he needs to say and he's speaking to the camera. And like that's always the number one rule with film is like, especially nowadays, it's so over the top with don't speak to the camera. You got to be smarter than the audience. You got to be doing all this crazy stuff that really at the end of the day, isn't that necessary. Audiences don't need to be feel like they're not seeing cliche. Cliche is okay. Like cliche is an okay thing to be looking at. And John has completely dropped off now. So hopefully he comes back at some point, but so many times people try to outsmart, try to be too original and all that. And it actually gets in the way. They try to get away from, oh, well, I was told in film school not to do blank. I was told in whatever not to do this. Or, oh, voiceover is bad. But anything is good if you can figure out how to do it the right way. And Woody Allen in this movie is able to do so much the right way and do it in an original enough way. I mean, that moment where they're standing in line for the movie and the guy behind him is just blabbing and blabbing and blabbing and blabbing. And Woody Allen looks at the camera, says how much he's annoyed by it, walks over, pulls the guy out from behind the poster and says like, here he is. This is the guy. So John's computer just crashed. He just told me that, but here's the guy. And this is the guy who's going to be able to, you know, tell you that you're wrong, that you don't understand anything about his work. Like those are the types of fantastical elements in this movie that really, really work that we don't see in a lot of romantic comedies or really just in a lot of comedies in general. I think that Woody Allen was able to keep it realistic enough because really his relationship with Annie Hall is incredibly realistic. It has no beginning and it has no end. Like in terms of linearity, is linearity even a word? I'm going to try to keep this going for as long as I possibly can before John comes back. But let's see, can he get back in? Let's see. Anyway, we meet them and he tells us right away, I can't believe me and Annie broke up, whatever. And then it starts getting into the actual relationship of them. And it never really tells you the order that things are happening. You can start to piece it together, but it's very fragmented, almost like Woody Allen or Alvy Singer in this movie is thinking through these moments of the relationship and what was important at these various moments throughout this entire time. And so he's got all of these things going on in his head, but he can't quite put them in order because he's dealing with the breakup and everything that's going on in that way. I think that the best thing about Annie Hall is the fact that it doesn't pull any punches with Alvy Singer or with Annie Hall. And I think that's the best thing about this movie. And that's what's so impressive about this movie all these years later, their relationship doesn't feel far off from any other relationship that you've either experienced or that you've seen or that you've been a part of. It feels so realistic. And at this point, this movie is getting close to 50 years old. It's 44 years old, I believe. 44 years old, getting close to 50. And it's a relationship movie. If you really go back and you look at some of these comedies that gained a lot of popularity back in the 30s, the 20s, the 40s, whatever it was, a lot of them will start to feel dated because we don't laugh at the same things that we used to laugh at. Drama is always drama. You know, so like that's why dramas tend to win Best Picture a lot of the time, because what you find dramatic at one time, you're probably going to find dramatic 10 years later. You know, but when it comes to a comedy, you can't tell me that you sit down and you literally will laugh as hard at a movie from the 30s as maybe you are about something now, because it's just not as relatable. And that's what it comes down to. To say something like Duck Soup isn't iconic, the Marx Brothers movie, is wrong. That's an iconic movie. But at the same time, while I can appreciate that movie, I can barely relate to that movie. And so then that ultimately ends up lowering that movie in my rankings because I can't really relate to it. So what am I supposed to do with a movie like that? So I think that's what's most impressive about Annie Hall, is Annie Hall has stood the test of time as a romantic comedy, a genre that can't even stand the test of time half the time from one weekend to the next with box office. But this movie was able to stand the test of time. Now, will it stand the test of time because of all the things come out with Woody Allen and all that? Who knows? They'll probably try to rub it in the dirt and get rid of it and whatever. But the way I always look at it is, when it comes to films, when it comes to movies, when it comes to any artist, every artist has issues. And I'm looking at Annie Hall as a movie, not as I like Woody Allen. And I've said this on this podcast before, and I'll say this again. If you start to base your favorite movies and your favorite books and everything on if a person is a good person, you're going to run out very, very quickly of movies, books, TV shows, and things like that, because everybody's got something in the closet that you're going to be like, oh, I'm disgusted with this. So I have American Beauty at number 2 on this list. And yeah, Kevin Spacey's a despicable person, but I still have him up there at number 2. So it's just one of those things. Can you separate these two aspects? And for me, I have no issue separating it. I mean, I really don't. And I mean, think about how many companies exist now that were started or run or whatever by these despicable people 100 years ago. You're still buying from them. You're still doing whatever with them. And Woody Allen. So will this end up hurting this movie over the course of time? Maybe. But I still think if you sit down and you look at this just as a movie, just as a movie, and you can put all the other stuff aside, it really is one of the all-time greats. It really, really is. It's one of the all-time great romantic comedies. John should be back in here shortly. He said that his computer is rebooted and he is figuring it out. So we will see. But, you know, it's just, it's one of those movies where, you know, it's a shame. I really don't think Woody Allen ever hit this level again. He has some other really good movies, but it's kind of like he starts to get into the shtick, which is fine. He is, at the end of the day, a stand-up comedian. He's a stand-up comedian who is doing all of his stand-up just in movie form a lot of the time. But there's something that just resonates with this movie, with Annie Hall singing Old Times and with it, with all that, with this hatred of moving on to something new, of going to California. He can't even handle, why would I go to California? Oh, you know, why would I want to go be around those trees and all that stuff? Like, it's so funny to see his just pushing against it while he's dating somebody who is completely new in that scene. Annie Hall is this new figure in this world. She's a totally different female character than we had really seen up until this point. And so he's going with her as this older guy, aging guy, and he's just trying to push against everything else that's going on. You know, it's very interesting to see. And I obviously love the conversations all about Los Angeles and California, because that is not the perspective. There's no crime. There's no crime here, Alvy, and blah, blah, blah. I think that's like one of the funniest lines in the entire movie, because, you know, now dude, that's like, I just lived in California. Like, there's plenty of crime in California. Like, you don't have to worry about crime. And I think John's back. And John, I just held my own for 10 minutes. So if you
I listened along to make sure we didn't retread over anything. I was quite impressed.
That's impressive.
But
how did I do?
Quite well. And I really enjoy the point that you were just making about the fact that it's like this idea of not moving on. And that's what Annie Hall does so well, is that a lot of the times these romantic comedies focus on this idea of love being like this eternal thing that lasts forever. But Annie Hall really focuses on the end of love and how love kind of fades, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's the line from the movie, is love fades. And it's just one of those interesting things that really kind of elevates it over other movies in the genre, is it feels so much more real because it's not providing this idea of like, oh, love's going to last forever. I'm going to be in love with this person forever.
Well, yeah, it cuts out the happily ever after. And I think that's why something like Eternal Sunshine resonates with people so much. And why I think that movie actually pulls a lot from Annie Hall, despite the fact that you might look at them and say they're not all that similar, but they are. And the thing with Eternal Sunshine is, at the end of that movie, they're sitting down and they're talking to each other, and it's like, well, you know, you're going to end up hating me. You're going to grow to hate me, but I won't. But you will. And they're having this argument of like, we already know that this isn't going to work out. So why are we even going to bother? It didn't work out the first time. You might think this is great and it's new and it's original and blah, blah, blah. And that's exactly what this movie is. It's kind of like they're going for the exact opposites of everything else they've gone for. He's been going for these like kind of stuck up, academic types. And now all of a sudden he gets Annie Hall who can't even, you know, she drives a car in New York. Who drives a car in New York? And my favorite line, we can walk to the curb from here. I love that line because nobody knows how to parallel park. It's so funny. But, but you know, it's just this whole going for the opposite, but how is that ever going to ultimately end up working out together? If somebody likes smoking weed like Annie Hall does, and he doesn't like that idea, how do you actually find a middle ground there of, okay, well, it's okay if you do it at this time and not this, like, it doesn't happen. It's very hard to find that. And so it's funny to me because this is like a movie about young love, but neither one of them is very young.
And that's kind of like, we kind of talked about this with like Itu Mama Tambien last week as well. And it's this idea of like these like genres that that are generally focused on a different generation, and how you can kind of still work that genre at an older age. And that's what we're having with Annie Hall here, is we have those middle-aged people. At the time we meet Woody Allen's character, he's already two marriages deep.
Yep.
And we don't really know what happened in those.
Yeah.
But we can kind of tell based on how his relationship with Annie goes.
Yep. Yeah, we can tell that it's probably on him.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's so nice about it, is because it is different. Generally, when we're dealing with these romantic comedies type of things, we're dealing with people in their 20s who are falling in love and, you know, pursuing it, and we don't really see the what happens next. But in Annie Hall, we're dealing with people in their 40s.
Yeah.
Or in late 30s, right? And they're real people. They feel so real. They're easy to connect to. And that is the experience so many of us have.
Yeah. And so there's this whole theory in film where it's make your characters young so they have their lives ahead of them. There's this idea that actually makes characters more interesting. It keeps people more invested in them because their whole future, they can go any direction. And that's why a lot of movies you will see, it's young people. It's not older people, because, you know, you make a movie like Amour, the Michael Haneke movie, or however you say his last name. And he makes that movie. It's about two old people dying. That's what that movie's about. That's awful. Like, yeah, that can be nominated for Best Picture and win Best Foreign Film. But I don't really want to sit down and watch a movie about two people dying. I'd rather watch it about, you know, two people finding their way in the world. That, like, how are they going to get here? And obviously there's differences. You can watch the journey of Michael Corleone from the first Godfather all the way through the third Godfather. But yeah, and you're seeing him at the end of the line and breaking down and all of that fun stuff. But you're watching the journey. And I think what's so amazing about this movie is you are watching the journey the entire time. We are watching the journey of Alvy Singer and Annie Hall, and we are watching Alvy Singer's journey through his own messed up mind. You know what I mean? Of his own messed up relationships, and how can he overcome his neuroses in order for his life to be better? How can he make that happen? And how can he find, you know, this Annie Hall? Is he like, is this his end all be all? How is he going to find another Annie Hall type person? This is like that whole manic pixie dream girl, whatever that was, John.
Yes. I have no idea.
This is that whole manic pixie dream girl thing, but it's done in such a subdued way, or not even a subdued way, but it's done in a way that Annie Hall still feels really realistic. And, you know, that's a trope that people always give a hard time because, you know, every female after you know, Eternal Sunshine, after Annie Hall, the follow-ups, it's always a manic pixie dream girl. It's always a manic pixie dream girl. John's having a dance over there with his internet.
Wow.
It's always whatever that is. I'm going to pop you off. It's like, okay, here you go. But it's always this manic pixie dream girl. And Annie Hall doesn't ever feel like she strays too far down that path. And I think like, yeah, she's unique. She's weird. She's got her things, but everybody's got their quirks. Mm-hmm. It's just, how are they being portrayed in the movie? And in this movie, they're very much being portrayed as she's the free spirit, but not in that manic pixie psycho way that we see so often. She's the free spirit just in the way of like, she's not overly neurotic and she's willing to live life, which Alvy Singer wants to be in his apartment in New York City. And that's it.
Well, and that's the very interesting thing that this movie kind of poses the audience too, is like, does Alvy want to be with Annie because he's actually in love with her? Mm-hmm. Or is it just the convenience of being in love with her?
Yes, that's a great point. And I think that's an interesting way to look at it, because is he more thinking back on what he was once? Is this his last shot at a younger woman who can make him also feel younger? Mm-hmm. Or is this his last resort of, I'm stuck and this is all I got? Like which one is it? And I think it's really fascinating because Annie Hall is one of the most iconic female characters in film history. Like, without a doubt, one of the most iconic female characters from, she changed fashion in the late 70s. And like, but she's not the main character of this movie. We are seeing her from the perspective of a neurotic old Jewish guy
who, so at the beginning of the movie, we're really told, right, especially when we consider at the beginning of the movie we're told that Alvy is not a reliable narrator.
He's not a reliable narrator. And then you start wondering, so what is he really like? How much of this is for show? And but that's the thing, like, I think that's what's awesome about Woody Allen knows that he's putting on a show for you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what annoys me a lot about new school type movies, is people try too hard to make something feel so realistic and not pull you out of the movie. And there's certain aspects where you shouldn't. If you're making Saving Private Ryan, I should feel like I'm in the movie the entire time. If you're in The Empire Strikes Back, I should feel like I'm in the movie, even though at the end of the day you're entertaining. But when you're doing something like this, where it's like, I'm very much making a point and I'm going to wink at the camera often, it's okay to break out of that mold. And this movie does a very good job with that. And it's telling you the whole time, like, this is the opinion of Alvy Singer thinking about it from his own perspective. And you know what? You might be just getting, you know, he's a TV writer. You might just be getting a TV writer's idea of what this woman really was like.
Yeah, exactly. And especially when we take into consideration the fact that at the very beginning of the movie, we see his nihilism.
Yeah.
As he's talking with the therapist and everything. And that at a young age, he was already kind of thinking, but what's the point? We're so infinitesimal. Like, there's no point in anything. So why is he in this pursuit of this woman? And, or anything at that point? Because he kind of just keeps drifting back into that nihilism, despite the fact that it's not restated in the film.
Yeah, and I mean, every time he gives her any, it's always, here's a book about death. Death is in the title. Well, how do you know that one's mine? Because I wrote my name in it. But you wrote your name in all my books because you knew this day was coming. And like, every book he's giving her has death in it. All the stuff he's thinking about is how, like, you know, eventually it's all going to end. Like, he can't stop. He can't help himself. Yeah. You know, that's just his way.
Yeah, exactly. And Woody Allen does just do such a phenomenal job of giving us this neurotic character who is incredibly negative the entire movie, yet mm-hmm. you're still not at the point where you're completely disgusted by his actions in the movie either.
Because it still feels relatable. Even with all of his actions and with how obnoxious he can be and how much he can rub you the wrong way, at the end of the day, you sit there and you say to yourself, man, this is a guy who's hurting because they had a good relationship. And if he could have changed, what could have been different for them? If he could have lived in California. And I love how at the end, she ends up moving back to New York. I love it. I think that's such a great finishing touch of she ended up coming back. We sat around, we talked about the old times, and that was it. Very similar to E Tu Mama Tan Bien. And don't tell me Alfonso Cuarón didn't know that. Like, don't tell me he didn't know what he was doing with that, because that is a very similar, almost identical ending, except instead of a gay relationship, it's a straight relationship. Like, it is almost the exact same thing of just two old friends getting together and talking about the old days. And so what that they had a relationship, like they lived through this really big moment together. It's really fascinating. And I don't know how you can go through this now. And I don't know why new school romantic comedies and stuff, maybe it's because we've seen it so many times, but why does it feel so difficult sometimes to build characters the way that Alvy Singer and Annie Hall are built in this movie, and Max, and like all the side characters? Why does it feel so hard for them to build these nowadays?
Characters don't make money. That's what it comes down to.
Sometimes Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker sure made money.
Yeah, but are they really characters? We'll get into that in a few minutes.
Yeah, that's true too. No, that's true. But at the same time, like, the romantic comedy genre, it doesn't make that much money anymore. It's just very cheap to make. That's the key. It's cheap to make. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, since you don't have to put in that much effort. I think about, what's that movie? What If, with Daniel Radcliffe and Zoe Kazan. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty decent romantic comedy from New School, but it takes two young, good looking people who at the time were pretty hot, because always Kazan was coming off Ruby Sparks and Daniel Radcliffe, obviously, you know, with Harry Potter. And you take the two of them and you make that work, making them a little bit more interesting. And I know you haven't seen that, mm-hmm. but it's just something that makes them a little bit more interesting. But it's still got to be cheap as anything, because they didn't do anything else in the movie. It's still about two people. So how do you find a way to make that work? How do you find that? That's a hard question to answer, but I feel like a lot of people are struggling with it, and I don't know why they're struggling so hard. Why don't we have an Annie Hall coming out every year? Like, why is this such a special movie? I guess that's what I'm trying to get to. What makes this movie so special? I know you only gave it 3.5, not 4 stars, but what is it about this movie that makes it one of those movies that shows up on AFI Top 100, shows up on the list of greatest comedies of all time, shows up on the list of greatest movies of all time? It's always discussed. Annie Hall gets referenced in songs and books and movie and everything all the time. What is it about this movie that puts it up there where it's discussed all the time?
Because the romantic infatuation isn't just with Annie Hall in this movie. It's also Woody Allen's infatuation with New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's why Manhattan doesn't work as well, because Manhattan is all about New York and it fails to focus on the women at all. But that's a good point. New York is a character in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And it helps just raise the movie up again, because it's like, could this story happen anywhere else? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it has to happen in New York. We have to have that scene of them looking over the New York skyline where they're kind of having that first conversation, and there's the subtext on the screen, which is fantastic.
I love that
in its own right. It's a fantastic scene. And we have to have the scene of the house under the roller coaster and stuff like that. And like, there's so much New York in this movie that if it happened anywhere else, it wouldn't be as good.
Yeah. Well, and you said, could it have happened anywhere else? It could, but Alvy Singer couldn't be the main character. That's the key. And just because we're coming up on the half hour here and we'll want to move on to Empire and take our time with that one, but a couple of things I just want to throw in with this movie. the text that is literally subtext, that is subtext yep. on the screen while they're having the conversation, the animation with the witch with the humongous boobs and the tight thing and all that, and there's little Alvy, the scene where it's the split screen of them talking to their therapist, the him coming out and talking to the camera when that guy behind him in line, all of that, the laugh tracks, how now you have to pay for your laughs because you can't get them themselves. All of those things throughout. One of my favorite scenes is when he doesn't feel good because he doesn't want to go on the show, and they start telling him, hey, you know what? You shouldn't do the show. Don't do the show. And all of a sudden he's like, oh, this chicken's really good, actually. And he just starts eating like crazy because that was where his neurotic whatever was coming from. All of those little things, it's these chances that this movie was taking to tell the story out of order, to not make it linear, to do all of that. It doesn't pass anymore. These types of movies need to be told in some sort of linear fashion now, just because of who the audience generally is for this movie. And I remember the first time I watched this movie, and John, I swear I'll let you get your last thing in here, but the first time I watched this movie was in high school. And the next day I went into English class, AP English, and I hadn't read the pages for whatever book we were reading. And I remember nobody in the class did. There were like 9 of us in the class. And the teacher went around and said, why didn't you read? Why didn't you read? Why didn't you read? Why didn't you read? And so I said, well, I didn't read because I watched Annie Hall with my dad. And he was like, really? And I was like, yeah, my dad wanted to watch Annie Hall. And he couldn't believe that two guys would sit down and watch Annie Hall, because it doesn't feel like a guy's movie. But at the end of the day, it actually is quite a guy's movie. This is a romantic comedy that totally fits both genders.
No, absolutely. And a lot of it comes down to just how smart this film is. It approaches the topic in a way that's relatable to everyone. It has those little niche Woody Allen moments, like the subtext, or one of my personal favorite scenes was the sex scene with the body versus mind.
Oh, awesome scene. Yep.
Right. And it's just those little things that are short, they're sweet, but they just punctuate everything happening in the film so well to make the audience understand exactly what's going on.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. You really are. And I forgot about that scene. But yeah, when he literally starts starting, this is what I'm talking about. Why are you over there? Well, because you won't let me smoke grass. It's brilliant. It really is. Yeah. It's brilliant. And it's something that I really believe, like as I was watching this again for the first time in a while, actually, it'd been a really long time, I was like, man, there's something special about this movie. And the fact that every time I watch it, I still get that feeling of like, ooh, that was different. I forgot that they did that. I forgot he went that route. Like so many moments in this movie that I think really, really work with that. So yeah, that's what I got. All right. What was the best movie you watched since you said you watched a bunch this week?
I did. Well, we're about to talk about one of maybe the most iconic sequels of all time. But I finally got around to one of the best sequels of all time, which was Paddington 2.
Oh, Paddington 2 is so good.
So it's incredible. I mean, we've already talked about the Paddington movies a couple of times now. But honestly, guys, if you haven't watched them, go watch them. They are some of the most entertaining movies you'll ever watch.
Oh, I totally, totally agree. I mean, the Paddington 2 is so entertaining. It's so fun. I love that. And it doesn't get like, I guess maybe because I'm not like, I don't have like a family right now, you know? So yeah. Maybe like, that's why I'm not noticing as much, but like, I know that movie has like really high ratings all across the board and everything like that, but that movie does not get brought up enough. And maybe that's because I talk to people in their late 20s and early 30s rather than people who are like 12, but it's so good. It's so damn entertaining. I love that movie. The best one I saw this week was I finally took the 3 hours and 20 minutes to watch Dr. Zhivago, because I figured on my day of 6 movies where I watched 2 Star Wars movies, 2 Ingmar Bergman movies, and Annie Hall, that I might as well also throw in a 3-hour and 19-minute movie, because when else am I going to have that kind of time where I literally have no other responsibility? Didn't really like the first hour, thought it was a little slow. The last 2 hours of that movie, though, are perfection. They make you feel so frustrated. That's another one. John has taught me so much about the Bolshevik Revolution. I feel like I'm getting somewhere. Dr. Zhivago really dives into that, and you feel frustrated. You feel angry. The performances are fantastic. The cinematography. David Lean is – I really believe that in the grand scheme of things, when movies no longer exist and aliens show up and they find these little dusty things – they're going to look at it and they're going to say with a very, what do you call it? I can't think of the word, but with no bias, they're going to sit down and say, David Lean's the greatest director ever, because just Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, The Bridge on the River Kwai. The fact that those three movies are put on film is insane. Yeah. And Dr. Zhivago is definitely bloated. It's definitely long. It's definitely, it's got its moments of like, ugh. But once it starts rolling, once it really gets into it, it's just like, how? How did you make this movie? And how do you pull this off back in the 60s? Lost Best Picture to Sound of Music, which it should have. Sound of Music is a better movie. I think. You don't think so?
I'm not a big Sound of Music fan.
Wow. Okay. That makes me feel happy. I like Sound of Music, but I do think it's a bit overrated, but I do think it's better than Dr. Zhivago. Dr. Zhivago, that first hour was better. And maybe I need to watch it again because the first hour really sets up the frustration for the last two. But yeah, that's what I got. All right, John, let's get into this steaming. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. We're talking about the really good sequel. Never mind. Let's talk about The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. So Empire Strikes Back has like this really meaningful part of my life, I guess. I've talked about it before. Like the first movie I saw in theaters was GoldenEye. I was like 3 when that movie came out. Not even. I don't really remember it.
Yeah.
So one of my first memories of a theater is the Battle of Hoth.
Mm.
So Empire really is important to me in that sense. It's also just a fantastic movie. But I am going to posit this to you, Phil. Star Wars movies are not science fiction movies and are rather fantasy films.
Yeah, they're fantasy films that are aging a lot worse than the Lord of the Rings movies are.
Yes.
Can I say that? Am I allowed to say that?
Yes.
Without making people angry? I love Empire.
Mm-hmm.
I love Empire a lot more because of nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that these Star Wars movies really have going for them. The one thing I will say about Empire, rewatching it this time, is every time I watch this movie, I want to watch Return of the Jedi. And then I get annoyed when I watch Return of the Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I watched Return of the Jedi almost immediately after watching it this week. Because I'm like, oh, damn, I want to watch how this ends. And then all of a sudden, I want to play Star Wars Battlefront 2, and I want to watch Revenge of the Sith. And, like, I want to, like, live my life through Star Wars.
Yeah.
I don't get that feeling with the first Star Wars. And I think the first Star Wars, as we just talked about with Annie Hall, actually aged poorly. And I know that's going to make a lot of people mad, but I think it's aged poorly. Mm-hmm. And I think the unfortunate thing for Empire is while Empire has built up this insane cult following, which is great because, I mean, if it wasn't for Empire Strikes Back, Star Wars would not be as popular a franchise as it is because it would have been a one-off. Return of the Jedi, yeah, it's a popular movie in terms of people watched it and it was money and whatever. But that's, you know, that wasn't alone. People couldn't live on A New Hope. The unfortunate thing for Empire is because Star Wars A New Hope came before it, It loses the credibility in terms of all the great things that it does for the genre. Because, oh, well, Star Wars A New Hope actually did it first, and this is just a sequel. What cracks me up is that 1977, Star Wars nominated for Best Picture. In 1980, when two good movies come out that year, two great movies, but, you know, Raging Bull and Ordinary People, Empire Strikes Back isn't nominated for Best Picture. And I think it's because it's just one of those movies that it doesn't get the credit. It gets the credit from fans for sure, but it doesn't get the credit aside from that because it's kind of viewed as like, well, it's the sequel. Yeah, it's better than the original. Most people will say it's better than the original, but they don't give it the credit for being groundbreaking like the original was. I think that's kind of where it's messed up.
Yeah, it's a really interesting aspect, especially when you consider the storytelling techniques applied to the original trilogy. Because if we look at A New Hope, it's just the hero's journey.
Yeah.
Right? It's such a cookie cutter plot. And like that is part of the reason why it doesn't age very well, is because it's so basic.
Yeah.
It's literally a story we've heard thousands and thousands of times, just kind of set in this kind of cool universe that isn't really all that fleshed out in A New Hope.
Yeah.
What Empire does is Empire then takes the hero's journey and again extends it over 3 movies instead of the single movie, but in a way where it starts exploring the universe more and giving more into everything. And that's the important thing, is in the end, this is kind of the same story as A New Hope.
Yeah.
There's not much different between the two films from a story perspective. But what we do have is we have incredible character development in this film.
Yep.
From the first one, Han Solo's character is infinitely better in Empire Strikes Back than he is in
yep.
A New Hope. Luke actually kind of starts getting a character in this movie mm-hmm. and isn't just whiny Luke. He's still whiny Luke, but he's not just whiny Luke
anymore. Yeah, I get you. My biggest problem with the Star Wars franchise in general, and again, I don't care who I make mad because I'm allowed to have my own opinions. My biggest problem with the Star Wars franchise in general is Mark Hamill has very little charisma. Mm-hmm. I really believe that. I don't think there's a reason Mark Hamill didn't become a leading man after this and Harrison Ford did. Mm-hmm. And while that's great, the problem with the third one and the first one is that Luke is the main character of those. And Mark Hamill is simply not that good of an actor. In the second one, Harrison Ford kind of takes over a little bit as the main character. And when Luke is the main character, he's hanging out with Yoda. And that's an interesting dynamic that we're like, all right, what are we doing here? And then he gets to Darth Vader.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two main Luke plot points in this movie. Mark Hamill doesn't have to do very much acting in this movie. Harrison Ford is finally the one who gets to be the suave guy. Great. That's what we want. But I think that's what ends up hurting these movies all overall. And I'm sure there's plenty of people who want to punch me in the face. But I don't think he has the charisma with a lot of this. But with this movie, the character development, you're spot on. Harrison Ford gets to kind of take over and Princess Leia gets to take over. Mm-hmm. That's what we needed. The first movie wasn't set up to be part of a trilogy. And it's very apparent that it wasn't set up to be part of a trilogy. The ending of the first movie stinks. Like, I will flat out say the first half hour of the first movie is pretty boring now. And the ending of the first movie, like that last thing of like pinning on medals and stuff, is Cornball City. I just kept thinking of Arrested Development with the Cornballer. And they all scream, F this, whatever. It's the Cornballer because... like everything in between is so incredibly well done, but it was so blatantly set up as just this one thing. Empire just says, boom, screw it, let's go. And that's why people have caught on to it so much, because you build out the world, you build out these characters, and you're letting us know now that this movie, it's picking up from somewhere that wasn't really left off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's picking up, though. They're just saying, we're going to skip the boring parts and go from here. But we're not going to end this because we're going to give you a conclusion later. It just works so incredibly well. And actually, after rewatching it this time and probably ended up dropping off two towers from my top 100 in due time, those are generally considered the two best middle movies of trilogies, because Godfather Part II was never considered the middle movie of a trilogy because the third one came out so much later. But in terms of what was supposed to be a trilogy, those are kind of considered the two best. I think Empire probably still beats the Two Towers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have it higher on my list.
Yeah.
I do think that. But I think a lot of it comes down to, like you were saying, the characters are fleshed out. We're finally focusing on these other characters instead of the generic hero character, which is kind of like the biggest flaw with the hero's journey, is that generally your protagonist isn't very exciting in those type of moot stories. But what we have here is we have other characters who are less defined morally and everything like that, because we still know Han is a smuggler and a criminal at this point, but we really see him take on that leadership role in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
We have Leia in the leadership role as well, and not just this like damsel in distress that she was in the first movie. As much of a badass as Leia is, like, she doesn't do a lot in A New Hope.
Yeah.
And then really what we get fantastically in this movie, though, is 3PO. Because God, Anthony Daniels, 3PO is
guy,
so hilarious in this film.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I can't stand 3PO. I can't stand 3PO. I'm telling you, like, God, you're probably the guy who defends Jar Jar Binks too, right?
No,
I just wanted to troll you. I wanted to see how far I could troll you before you actually, like, you know, killed me. No, I can't stand 3PO. You know what I think my biggest problem with 3PO is? And there's something endearing about 3PO, obviously. Like I'm not like I sit on Star Tours at Disney World. Mm-hmm. Like I like that. Like that's fine. But I think it's the fact that now, 40 years later, 3PO just slows the movie down, in my opinion. And yep. You probably disagree because you think he's great comedic relief, but I think his comedic relief comes at the expense of everything he does and says is very slow. He walks slow. He moves slow. And in an action movie, a fantasy action movie that's paced mm-hmm. like this one is, he slows down the pace of the movie. Like it's the trees in Two Towers. He just slows down. And you love both of them. You are easily entertained.
Sometimes. But I think the thing with 3PO in this one is he's not as relevant to the plot as he is in A New True. Hope or Return of the Jedi. And a lot of it, the thing is they have that running gag in this about the odds in this film, right? Mm-hmm. Where 3PO is always spouting the odds, but then, you know, eventually Han snaps back. And yeah, I do get it when like he does kind of slow things down a little bit, like on Bespin when he gets attacked by the stormtroopers and blown up and stuff. Yeah, he slows that bit down a little bit. But I think his presence otherwise is just there to give that little bit of comedic relief, because we're also not seeing him play off in a duo with R2 in this film either. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that definitely comes more in the third one. Where they become a duo again, whereas in this one, and I think that's what's impressive about this movie is this movie very much says, I'm going to split up a lot of what made the first one popular. Mm-hmm. Han and Luke barely interact in this movie. They mm-hmm. barely interact. I think the only time they interact is when Han goes out and saves them. That's it.
Yep. Chosen minutes on Han. That's about it.
Yeah, that's it. And Chewie and Han, they don't have any really massive moments together in this movie. Like they don't. You bring in Lando Calrissian, who's a totally different character, who's now going to come in and kind of be that Han-ish type. What are we going to do with this? You don't have Obi-Wan Kenobi. So a lot of the things, and it's these really aggressively strategic decisions that pay off almost every single time. And I think that's what's most impressive about this, is that it's always paying off. And from storytelling perspective, if you cut out the fact that this movie was made 40 years ago, so there's going to be things that are dated and, you know, there's going to be certain aspects of it where you say, that was probably so much cooler back then, whatever. But from a storytelling perspective, the decisions they made to split up these main characters, to split up these other groupings, to tell the story of a guy going to speak to a little green guy, to tell the story of Luke and of Han and Leia, make it apparent right from the beginning that their love story is going to be something that's very integral to this. All of those decisions to bring Darth Vader much more into the fold here, they all work. Every one of them works.
Well, and that's kind of the other thing is, like, let's get into the Vader of it all. Mm-hmm. Vader's in, what, 16 minutes of A New Hope?
Yeah.
And he's not in much more of this. But now we're kind of starting to see his actual villainous side, because he's like, he was a figurehead and like a terrifying character in A New Hope, but we didn't really see him do anything in A New Hope other than like, you know, choke a couple people. Mm-hmm. But in this one, we see he's more devious, more conniving. We get a lot more mm-hmm. character in Vader in this.
Yep.
And because of that, we're really working towards this idea that, okay, Vader is this big bad, but we've also just introduced that there is someone Vader takes orders from.
That's where I almost wonder, what if they could have went back knowing we're going to get three movies, and George Lucas probably would have effed it up. But what if they could have went back knowing they were going to get three movies? How would they have done it differently in the first movie? Would Darth Vader have been as massive of a villain as he was, even though he's only in 16 more minutes? Or would they have tried to push the Emperor into that movie? And how would that have actually impacted the story? Would that have been a bad thing? I personally think the Emperor is a great villain. I think it's a super interesting villain. I think it's interesting the way that he's in this movie. He's in it for a split second just for him to be talking to Vader. And like you said, now we know Vader isn't actually the big bad. That's such an interesting idea when it comes to a character like this, because that's like, we all are sitting here. You just made one of the most iconic villains of all time 3 years earlier. Now you're going to say, hey, here's a different villain. And the Emperor's creepier looking. The Emperor has no heart, anything like that. But I think because they wanted to make Vader more human, and pull back the layers and say this is actually going to be Luke's dad, you have to create another big bad, because you need to create some sort of humanity from Vader that was 100% missing in the first movie.
Yeah, exactly. And because we finally get that, it leads up to some of these reveals in this film to be so good. The obviously, the reveal of "No, I am your father" is iconic, and I mean, probably one of the most iconic twists in all of Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
But like, that doesn't work if we're just looking at the Vader from A New Hope.
Yeah. 100%. 100%. It doesn't work at all if we're looking at the Vader from A New Hope. Doesn't work even in the slightest bit. Because if we're looking at the Vader from A New Hope, we're like, God, like, so what? Like, that sucks. Your dad's a heartless guy who walks around in a black helmet all the time. Like, that stinks. But to give him this humanity, is it in this one? And I can't remember because I literally watched them back to back. Is it in this one where we actually see him with the helmet off or no?
We get a glimpse of him with the helmet off. Yeah, we get the glimpse of him with the helmet off while he's in the chair and
he's lowering his head.
Yeah.
That is such an unbelievably important shot in film history, because it really does. It's like, this is a person. This isn't some robot. This isn't General Grievous, but best villain in all of Star Wars, by the way, General Grievous. So much humanity to him. if anybody hasn't watched the Red Letter Media Plinkett reviews of the Star Wars prequels, you should watch them. It's one of the funniest things you'll ever watch in your entire life. It's like a YouTube series from back in like 2010, 2011. It's very, very R-rated. That's all I'm going to say. But it is endlessly quotable. And there's this thing where it's like, here's something interesting. And he talks with a stupid accent. And it's Obi-Wan versus Vader. And it's like, look at the emotion, the heart, the this. And it goes, what the F is this? And it's just General Grievous spinning his like 8 lightsabers while running at you. And then it just cuts the next thing. But anyway, I just think about that. But totally lost my train of thought because I thought about General Grievous. But we know that he's a human. We know there's now a human beneath this. And now you're starting to peel back the layers of this, but not in a way that a lot of movies make mistakes. You think about a movie like The Silence of the Lambs. Every movie that came out with a sequel to Silence of the Lambs or a prequel to Silence of the Lambs tries to humanize Hannibal Lecter. F that. Hannibal Lecter's a psychopath. We want him to stay a psychopath. Origin stories normally ruin villains because then they become a lot less scary.
Yeah.
Keep them not scary. That's all. And so, this is such a – it's one shot in the middle of a movie, in the middle of a trilogy, and it's one of the most important shots ever.
Yeah, and what's even more important is it's preceded by the Imperial March. Because the Imperial March does not exist in A New Hope. Its first appearance in the trilogy is in The Empire Strikes Back. And what John Williams does with this one piece is he really – it's a very heavy and very terrifying piece that really shows the power of the Empire. And it's become synonymous with Vader, despite the fact that it's really showing like the Empire as a whole. But after we hear that for the first time, all of a sudden we see, oh, Vader's kind of human.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
It's such smart direction. Putting it all together.
And essentially at that point, it's saying like something bigger, something more powerful is the reason why this guy is the way he is. We get hints of it throughout all of A New Hope. And obviously with what's going on with Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader, they're hoping that they're going to get a sequel. But if there was no sequel, we still would have been like, oh, okay, like he did this. And then that's why Obi-Wan was able to help Luke defeat Vader. Like, that's fine. That is a beginning, a middle, and an end to the story. But we get hints of there's something more to him. Who is this person? But he's never called Anakin Skywalker. He's never called by a human name. Not that Anakin's really a human name. But he's just constantly addressed as Vader, Lord Vader, all that. There's no humanity to him. And now it's like, hey, there is something bigger that made this guy the way he is. And that's why it's ultimately so disappointing when, like, Chancellor Palpatine is as much of a dud as he is in the original prequels. Because it's like, oh, this is the guy who convinced Vader? Oh, okay. Awesome.
I mean, other than the fact that Sheev Palpatine is the second best character in the prequels.
Is that
I mean,
a compliment to the to him, or is that just a
negative? Oh, no, I think Sheev Palpatine is one of the greatest characters in all of Star Wars.
Oh, you really? Okay, okay.
I'm a Palpatine guy.
Okay.
I'll give it to him. But a lot of that does come from some of the more auxiliary aspects of the Star Wars universe and stuff like that.
I don't have time, John. I don't have time.
Well, luckily I did at some point.
Yeah.
But like, and that's the thing, is like, ultimately we have this kind of robotic villain who has this human side, but then is still being conquered and ruled by this human in the end too, right? So it really goes as this really interesting way of showing that what is the Empire, and it kind of builds into themes we get later on in the series about like the humanity of the Empire stuff. Because a lot of people forget there's kind of a line in A New Hope in which, you know, Luke was going to go be a stormtrooper.
Yeah.
Right? So like the Empire really kind of flips around in A New Hope, and in this one, it's the Empire Strikes Back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at no point are we supposed to think, oh, yes, the heroes are going to win this movie that is totally dedicated to the villains.
Yeah, and I think like it's so interesting to name the movie that, because you're blatantly stating that this is going to end badly the entire time for the heroes. And I think that's why this movie has gained so much love over time. And why, like, to me, this is such an interesting movie, whereas a lot of these other Star Wars movies, or when I get into Marvel movies and things like that, don't interest me. It's nice to see the bad guy win sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the bad guy wins, it makes a more compelling story, because now you think, hey, could our heroes lose? And you don't know. Could somebody die in this movie? Like, we really don't know. Like, what is going to happen to Han Solo? I don't know. Maybe Harrison Ford doesn't want to come back for the next movie. Maybe he's happy being Indiana Jones. You know what I mean? Like,
no way that would happen, though, right?
No way that would happen. But he could have easily just done that. And now it's okay, he's dead. Like, but it creates so much more tension for the later scenes, because even when Luke and Vader and all them, when they're having this fight at the end of Return of the Jedi, that becomes more compelling, because you're saying to yourself, well, could something possibly go wrong for Luke, where then Vader actually becomes like, has to come in as some sort of hero? And he does, but that's more compelling because it's set up that way, rather than just, hey, our heroes are invincible and nothing bad ever happens to them.
Well, and that's the thing, is like, if this was your kind of like, if this is the second act in this three act story, nothing good happens at the end of a second act of anything
ever. So all hope is lost.
Yeah. So what we have here is we do have that. And it's so great, because it does feel so different for a mainstream movie to be like, no, the bad guys win.
Mm-hmm.
There no ifs, ands, or buts about it. The bad guys win in every single aspect. Luke has just found out his father is a literal space Nazi.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He gets his arm cut off. Han's frozen in kryptonite and off to Jabba the Hutt. Like, there is nothing good at the end of this movie.
Yeah, because Luke doesn't listen.
Yeah, but it still leaves you with that tinge of hope.
It does.
And one of the biggest flaws I find with this movie is it's really hard to tell how, over what course of time does this film take place. Fun fact, it's about a month.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's really hard to tell, because Luke's story feels like it does take over time, because he's training with Yoda and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Han and Leia's story feels like it took place 5 minutes after the invasion of Hoth.
Yeah, the two stories do not feel like they line up at all, because they come out of Hoth, they go to the Sky City, and now all of a sudden Luke is showing up.
Yeah.
There's a nitpick for you.
Yeah, well, apparently, like, in the extended universe, it's all explained, but that's all legacy stuff now, and it doesn't count.
It doesn't count at all. Gotta tell me in your movie. You can't cop out and say, oh, well, I did it later.
Yeah, exactly. And it is one of the things, but Luke training on Dagobah is so important to this movie, because, again, let's go back to the hero's journey. One of the important things about the hero's journey is finding the wise old sage to teach them about things. And we already had that in Obi-Wan, but we're going on to an older, wiser sage with Yoda, who trained Obi-Wan, apparently, which still was never really explained in anything, but whatever.
At all. I know, and that's where, like, everybody wanted the Obi-Wan prequel, and then Solo was such a disaster that there was none.
It's okay. We're getting an Obi-Wan series. We're fine.
Yeah, but I don't want to watch a series. Like, a series that takes up too much of my life. I'm watching Dark for the second time. I've watched Lost 8 times, and I've watched Game of Thrones, like, 13. I don't have time for a series. doesn't fit into my schedule.
See, I feel Star Wars is more geared with the extensive universe building that Star Wars has at this point. It needs a series to flush out things, to not give us the generic plots that two of the three sequel movies gave us.
Yeah, the second one and the third one. And I do agree with you though that Star Wars, anything that's like world building, does generally work better as a series. But that's why normally it would be a trilogy, or that's why it would be a like whatever, because it just works better to be able to take your time with it. Lord of the Rings is 9 hours long. If you watch the extended versions, you got like 12 hours of movie. That's a TV series, but it's three movies.
Yes.
And so like, yeah, that kind of it, though, like fantasy, like you said, it's a fantasy. It's not science fiction. Fantasy movies are better when they're as a series generally. Yep. And that's, you know, when you see a lot of these movies try to cram it all into one, it gets chaotic. It's all over the place. Game of Thrones is a fantasy series. You can't make that a movie. That has to be a series.
Exactly. And like circling back to Dagobah, one of the best parts about Dagobah is the cave scene.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and a lot of people will speculate, you know, Luke fighting Vader and seeing his own face there is this like hint at the fact that Vader is Luke's father and everything. And yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's more showing the fact that Luke is following a similar path to what Anakin followed to become Vader.
Yeah.
Right? And there's all this concern. Yoda has the concern when Luke first shows up. Hey, you got to be committed to this training. You have to finish it. Otherwise, you know, the dark side will be strong and it'll be calling you. And then what's he do? He's like, okay, I'm gonna peace. I have to go help my friends because I have this vision of them. But okay, I'll be back, I guess. And it puts him in such a point where we don't know what's going to happen in this conflict with Vader.
Mm-hmm.
We think because we've seen the first movie that Luke's going to be triumphant and he's going to overcome evil. But then Vader drops the "I am your father," and he's like, join me, and together we can rule the galaxy. And at that point, you're like, I don't know what Luke's going to say here.
And you're kind of hoping, part of me always hopes that he'll say, sure, and then it becomes Han and Leia versus Luke and Darth Vader, because that would have been an epic finale. Instead of Ewoks, and instead of stupid-looking things that are in Jabba's little cave thing, you know, instead we get, like, that type of battle, I would have been all in.
It's just one of those interesting things when it comes to Empire. And it did really lay the foundation, like you said, it laid the foundation for what Star Wars was to become. Mm-hmm. It's why we have 11 Star Wars movies.
12. Whatever. We forgot the Clone Wars.
The animated I did one. Forget the Clone Wars, because I do forget that movie a lot because it's so inferior to the series of the same name.
I'm just going to sit here and I'm just going to help you remember Star Wars, because I'm the real Star Wars fan.
So 12 movies, four different series, four main Disney series at this point, and you know, a plethora of legacy material out there through video games and books and novels and everything under the sun. Like, this is one of the biggest IPs in the world.
Oh, yeah.
It's easily one of the most recognizable. You can. It's hard to find someone who hasn't seen Star Wars or hasn't who doesn't know they should mention they've never seen Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you find somebody who's never heard of Star Wars, you have truly found somebody who lives under a rock. My thing with this is, and this is like my last point on this, because I love Empire, but at what point does it become too much? Because what's interesting about Star Wars is Star Wars went the opposite way of like Marvel and such. Marvel, DC, they start as comics, then they work their way up, TV shows, crappy movies, good movies, back to crappy movies. Sorry. But Star Wars started as movies and then kind of has worked its way backwards into novels. Like, you don't adapt a movie into a novel. You adapt a novel into a movie. You don't adapt a movie into a comic. You adapt a comic into a movie. Like, it's worked its way backwards. We have theme parks. We have all this stuff. At what point, though? Because it happens with everything. Let's be real. At what point does it eventually get to the point of it's too much and people have now lost a little bit of interest in it?
Well, I thought Rise of the Skywalker was that, but then I was still super excited to watch everything that was released after that. So I don't know. I think it's the point where you consistently get to the point where you can't tell good stories anymore. And the thing is that this universe is so vast that there are always good stories to tell. You just have to find them. And one of the problems, we'll talk about this when we get to The Last Jedi, because yes, I do have The Last Jedi higher than Empire Strikes Back, and I will defend that when we get to it in like 12 weeks or whatever
John,
it is.
John, those drugs, everybody. John, those drugs.
But one of the problems with the sequels is that it's so focused on the Skywalkers, who are literally the least interesting people in the entire universe.
So uninteresting. And
that's what makes some of these other projects, some like the Clone Wars or even like the Mandalorian, so much more interesting, is because they're focusing on these more everyday people who are just involved in the workings of what's going on. And it poses more moral questions. It gets deeper in these TV series than it ever did in these movies, mm-hmm. where these movies are just good versus evil.
Yeah.
There's no deeper themes to this. It's not about the ambiguous, like, moral gray area of good versus evil. It's just there's good, there's bad. We need Vader one or the is other.
Starting to get into the gray area by the end of the third one.
Yes, but he's more passing on to the good side again.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, like, his final act of good abstains him from all the evil he did, apparently,
yes, yes.
and lets him be a Force ghost and stuff. But that's the thing with Star Wars. Is Star Wars lends itself to this vast world where everyone can be engaged. And at this point, everyone can be engaged multi-generationally.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you talked about it. Empire Strikes Back. Is it a perfect movie? No. It's not a good standalone movie. You need to know what happens before it. You need to know what happens after it for it to be a fantastic movie that it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But the biggest thing with it is that it hits that nostalgia level. It's why they can keep making Star Wars over and over again. It's because it's nostalgic. It's because everyone born after 1977 sees Star Wars as a kid at some point. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they tell their friends that they haven't seen Star Wars and everyone gets mad at them. But, I mean, I saw this movie in theaters because I was lucky enough for them to be re-released in 1997.
Yeah, they re-released them all. I saw them in theaters, too.
Yeah. That was a lucky thing for someone born
20 years 14 after.
14 yeah, years after the fact, right? So, but every generation since then has grown up with Star Wars.
Yeah.
Because we had the re-release of the original trilogy, then we had the prequel trilogy. And then a decade later, we got the sequel trilogy. And Star Wars has just become this ever-present part of popular culture mm-hmm. that makes it so easy to connect with people.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what ultimately ends up happening, because there was that period of time where they were going to make a Star Wars movie every year. And
so that glad they decided not to.
because Solo really wasn't successful. That was really the problem was. And the thing is, Christmas is great because Christmas comes once a year.
Mm-hmm.
You don't treat every day the way you treat Christmas, because every day comes every day. Mm-hmm. And so that was the thing. When you're putting one out every year, okay, Lord of the Rings got away with that because they did it three times.
Yes.
Star Wars was trying to do it over the course of like 10 years.
Yeah.
You're asking a lot of people there to keep interest, and then it starts to feel, okay, well, if Solo feels too much like Rogue One, which feels too much like The Last Jedi, which feels like, now it's like, well, what are we doing here? And it started to feel like Solo was not successful. It really wasn't. And
which is weird, because it was the better of those two movies anyways.
I mean, that's, you know, we can
not saying a lot, because Rogue
that's,
One
yeah, that
not
to
good.
Me, that's like great. Like, The Phantom Menace might still be better than both. So whatever. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just funny to see what this really to me is the beginning of Star Wars. This is the beginning. This is more so the beginning of Star Wars than the new, at least what Star Wars is today. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like Star Wars has drifted very far away from what Empire Strikes Back was.
Yes.
I feel like it has drifted very, very far. And that's unfortunate.
It's okay. We get a chance to talk about it in a few weeks.
We do. We'll get there. When we talk about which one did you have? Attack of the Clones? You have Attack of the Clones there? Anyway. John,
I also like that one the most out of the prequels. So
I like Revenge of the Sith the most. But honestly, Attack of the Clones isn't as bad as people make it seem.
It's
perfectly fine. All right. Anyway, that's it. We're moving on. Number 68 next week. We are talking about Hereditary from 2018, and we are talking about Jaws from 1975. So I'm sticking in the 1970s, and I'm trying to stick with blockbusters, but John wants to go to little-known horror movies. So thanks a lot, John.
Well, we have to start spooky season right.
We're starting spooky season right. We're going Hereditary into The Exorcist. We're doing Hereditary and Jaws, so a little horror movie thing. Going to The Exorcist, and then we're skipping right to Christmas with Edward Scissorhands. So, hey. And then John literally does have 10 Cloverfield Lane, Screaming the Birds. Like, that's pretty much our October. Well done.
Yeah, there you go.
That's not bad. That's not bad. But anyway, this was fun. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back again next week. Not sure the date or anything. We're going to be moving around a little bit until we actually figure it all out. So, bye, everyone.
Bye.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time, and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.